our first session, which is going to be on immigration. Basically, the question of what are the forces that are driving immigration, that are migration, really? What are the forces in Mexico and Central America specifically that are pushing people to leave their lands and their cities, wherever their homes, and to make the journey northward to North America? And many of these forces, actually, that we'll be talking about are similar in Europe as well. I spent 3 years living in Montpellier, France, the south of France. And there were lots and lots of immigrants from North Africa and from all over Africa, actually, who had moved into France. And there was a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment in France during the time that I was there. It's just increased, from what I understand, because there's just a massive movement of peoples from the southern hemisphere to into the northern hemisphere, all over the globe. Anyway, what I'd like to do is look at what some of these push factors. Immigration experts talk about push factors and pull factors that drive migration. You know, the push factors are what we're going to look at now, sort of the conditions of life in Honduras specifically, which I think is fairly representative of a lot of Mexico and Central America, and actually fairly representative of what's happening in many places in Africa as well. And then I want to look also at sort of popular theology, kind of village level, street level theology, people's conception of God, and where God fits into this push, these push factors. So anyway, why don't we, if someone could turn the lights off over there, and we'll just go ahead and start out with a slide, some slides. For those of you who are familiar with Central America, you probably know that Honduras is right in the center of Central America. It borders on with Nicaragua to the sort of to the east, and then El Salvador to the south, and Guatemala to the sort of to the northwest. And Honduras is a very poor country. It's the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere after Haiti. In 1980, my wife Gracie and I, we were planning on taking a trip all the way through South America, but we ended up not getting any further than Guatemala, where we were found ourselves in the middle of a civil war. But we had hoped to sort of to expose ourselves to the situation of poverty and to look at alternatives, you know, like grassroots development efforts that were happening in Central America. And But first of all, we needed to learn Spanish, so we settled into a little village, a town, actually a fairly large town, Quetzaltenango, and started taking Spanish in an intensive language program. And while we were there, we were just completely overwhelmed, actually, by the civil war that was happening around us. I mean, there were hundreds of people showing up every month, dead, you know, killed by the death squads, right wing death squads, and. All of our teachers in our school, the language school where we taught, were actually most of them were urban guerrillas. Were active. They were university students, and at the time we didn't know they were urban guerrillas. I found out later that most of them were active, and they were using their job. They were taking their job as a way to educate North Americans about the situation in Guatemala, which they blamed on the U.S. and rightly so in many ways. So anyway, we had 7 hours a day, one-on-one, 7 hours a day, 5 days a week with a language teacher. And then the next week, we would switch and have a different language teacher and the same thing, 7 hours a day, 5 days a week. And this was just an incredible, like, eye-opening education for us, not just of Spanish. Spanish was just one small part of our education. But these university students were teaching us about what was happening in their country and the whole history of their country. And while we were there, the language school had to close down because of the violence. And the Pan-American Highway, the main highway going through Guatemala down to the Guatemala City, closed down, and while the army went and burned a lot of the villages and massacred, you know, all kinds of people. And when we were there, I had a book that had, it was liberation theology, you know, like it was excerpts or anthology of liberation theology that I'd actually kind of smuggled into Guatemala. I mean, I'd been told that I shouldn't bring anything that could be considered subversive in any way when we crossed the border, and so I got rid of a lot of my more overtly subversive books, you know. I sent them all back from San Cristobal de las Casas in the south of Mexico and Chiapas, and I thought, oh, this can't be that bad, you know. I mean, I grew up in a suburb of Seattle and had never been exposed to anything like this. But we crossed the border, and it's before we had our language training, and found ourselves stopped about six times in the first hour and a half. And each time, soldiers came on with submachine guns and motioned us off, they wouldn't motion everyone off, they motioned us off every time. And there'd be people with their machine guns aimed at us, while others went through all of our luggage, and then went through every one of the books we carried, carefully looking through the books. And the one liberation theology book we had stuffed way down deep underneath, wrapped in some underwear or something, and that never got looked at. But I'm telling you, we were really scared by the time we finally got up to the town of Quetzaltenango. And then a rumor went around about after a month of being there that there was going to be a house-to-house search, that the army was going to be doing a house-to-house search for weapons and literature, subversive literature. And so I thought, oh, that can't be true. I'm sure a huge city of Quetzaltenango, they're going to do a house-to-house search. And people said, oh, yeah, you know. Last time they did it, any literature they found that was considered subversive, and sometimes it just maybe had a red cover on it, they'd shoot the whole family. And I just couldn't believe that my book was that serious of a problem. It was like, it wasn't even a radical book, really. But one day I came home from my language instruction, and I was staying with an attorney and their family. You know, we all lived with, all the students lived with different families. And the attorney pulled me aside and said, you know, Ernesto Cardenal, huh? You know, what do you think about that? And, you know, what do you have a book like that for? And I'd hid this book underneath my mattress. And the family had gone through just to make sure I didn't have anything bad, and found this little advertisement in the very back flap of the book for some book by Ernesto Cardenal. And that was enough for me to have to destroy the book. You know, so I mean, that's the kind of climate it was. Anyway,
what year was that?
That was in 1980 or 81. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that led to a decision. I felt like a lot of things were kind of coming clear in my life. I'm telling you this whole story, I think you'll see why. It's kind of an introduction to the whole series, but, you know, we're going to get to Honduras soon enough here. But that experience, I was meeting with language teachers who were all pretty militant atheists, and they would say things like, you know, the church has just been part of this whole thing, you know, the church has been supportive of the right-wing governments that have had this reign of terror, and the U.S. has been supporting all this, and most American missionaries have been supportive of it. Of course, I met all kinds of other sort of missionaries who, you know, who were quite active in resisting all this. And there were a minority of those sorts of folks out and about, and very committed people. But anyway, we were told basically by these students that Christianity was something that they were just going to shelve, or that needed to be, they were militating against it because it was part of all the repression. And so I would do things like I would share with them. I mean, that caused me to sort of reread the Bible in many ways, and that's what I was doing. I was very challenged, and I would bring texts up, you know, like Isaiah 58 or you know, Luke chapter 4, different texts that were sort of the obvious texts that kind of showed a more liberation perspective. And I'd read them to the teachers, my language teachers, in my new, you know, kind of broken Spanish, and they would be really surprised that was in the Bible, and that would lead to all kinds of discussions. And so actually I was engaging theologically with, I was engaging these teachers, and they were engaging me, and that led to just a kind of a new excitement, and actually a feeling of vocation, like I was experiencing maybe a call. I was getting so excited about being there and dialoguing with these people that I ended up calling up my girlfriend Gracie, and I asked her to fly down, and I said we could probably find some priest or someone that would marry us, and she said, oh, for sure, you know, I'll do it, you know. So the next day I called her back and said, I'll just come up and we'll get married and then we'll come back down. You know, there's no point. We want our families to be able to participate. So I went up, and a week after our wedding, we were back in Mexico City and traveling south into Guatemala. And we lived and studied and traveled all through Central America for 6 months. And that led to our decision to want to work somewhere in Central America addressing the root causes of poverty. And we visited many different missionaries and people who said, hey, you know, don't do what we did. You know, we went and got our PhDs in agriculture and all this stuff. And when we came down here, we found that it was all useless. We had to relearn everything. So they just encouraged us to, you know, to just learn from successful development projects and missionary, or, you know, local church endeavors, and just if we could find someone that would mentor us, just to try to plug in somewhere. So we did. We found a group. First of all, we found a support group that we actually came up here to finish our university, our last years of college, and we ran into this community that we'd known before, but one of the members of the community was this Mennonite guy who just retired from teaching physics at Wheaton College. And he had just discovered that he had $100,000 worth of Wang computer stocks. So he said, you know, I can't use that money. I didn't work for it. Someone had given him like this Wang computer stocks when they weren't worth anything. So he donated it to this little church, and they formed a mission committee. And that mission committee decided to just send us and support us to do grassroots development. So what I'm going to present now is here we ended up in this town of Minas de Oro, right in the center of Honduras. What I want to present is just what I learned sort of about the realities of poverty and underdevelopment, or, you know, that really are the forces that are driving immigration. You know, most of the peoples of Central America do not have running water, you know, especially in the rural areas. They'll do all of their cooking, I mean, all of their washing and bathing in creeks and rivers. You know, life is just very, very tough, you know, for the majority of people, especially in rural areas. And this is part of what is pushing people to, you know, to leave the countryside and to head to where they know life's a little easier. Most of the people have to do all of their, they cook over wood-burning stoves, which means they have to scavenge for firewood every day. And that gets more and more difficult because the population is growing in all through Central America. The population growth rate right now in Honduras is about 3.4%, I think, which is the highest in the Western Hemisphere. So, you know, you have lots and lots of little babies being born, and there's more and more pressure on the land to sustain this subsistence culture, really. You know, people have to go further and further to collect firewood, and most of the folks are subsistence farmers throughout Mexico and Central America, the rural areas, and really all of the migration that's happening, the biggest migration of peoples to North America is coming, you know, from peasants who've left the land, you know, and gone to the cities, and gone from the cities to, you know, to taking the dangerous journey northward. So anyway, most of the folks are people that have to subsist off of whatever land they have. And subsistence involves a huge amount of work. Most people don't have any salary. What they do is they try to eke out a living off of whatever land they have. If they don't have land, then they have to work for whoever will hire them. And the daily wage in Honduras right now, you know, from say 6 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon is $1 a day. Okay, and in the little stores in every village, a lot of the things are imported from outside of Honduras. And so everything is very expensive. I mean, $1 a day does not even buy enough. Doesn't even buy the beans that one family need, the two pounds of beans that a large family would need, you know, just for their daily ration of beans alone. Okay, so that's, if there's one person working, if there's work, I mean, that's not enough to meet their needs, right? So anyway, a lot of people do have little plots of land, but like in countries like El Salvador, most of the people don't even have land. You know, so they're completely dependent upon whoever will hire them. In contrast, the flat land, which is the prime agricultural land, is almost always in the hands of the wealthy elite in Central America and Mexico. In Honduras, there's a saying that the cows live better than the people. The people kind of say that, and they smile, and they don't say that with bitterness. They just kind of say it as a fact, and it is a fact, you know, that a lot of the flat, prime farmland in our region was owned by a few professional people, doctors, and, you know, people that were wealthy who didn't even live in the area. They lived in the capital city where they had practices as dentists or doctors, and they had foremen who would manage all their herds, and they'd go out on weekends. They'd drive their brand new Toyota four-wheel drive Jeeps out into the and stay in their nice fancy houses out in the countryside, and they'd have all the people doing all the work for them, and they would just buy up whatever land they could buy, from people that were wanting to leave and to migrate to north, you know, to the cities. So our whole project, what happened is we ran into a man named Elias Sanchez, who was a specialist in intensive hillside agriculture. And we had no background in agriculture ourselves. We both were EMTs, emergency medical technicians, and, you know, we figured, oh, maybe we could do some teaching in basic, you know, kind of preventative health. And actually, our first job in Honduras was to work with the United Nations, with Mennonite Central Committee in the United Nations, receiving refugees who were fleeing from El Salvador and Honduras. You know, our role was to go with United Nations flags and, you know, kind of go out in the area where the army, the El Salvadoran army and the Honduran army were roaming right along the border area, and just yell out, you know, and for the people to come out of hiding, and then we'd accompany them to the refugee camps. So we went down without any very many skills, you know. I was a history major, Gracie was a literature major. So, you know, about the most agriculture we'd ever done would be like spreading beauty bark around rhododendrons and hedging lawns. But we met this man, Elias Sanchez, who said, hey, you know, if you want to help our people, you just have to help us increase production of basic grains. And we said, well, we don't know anything about, you know, how to do that. And he says, well, you know, you guys have the intellectual skills to be able to analyze and learn, and I can find you a Honduran peasant who's a master organic intensive farmer. And he can teach you guys all that. And you guys can start a model farm and develop a training center. And so he recruited us, basically, to go out and to try to stop migration at its roots. And his whole purpose, you know, in his program was to get out and to help small farmers subsist off of the most marginal possible land and get maximum yields off of minimal land. And he was very skilled at it, you know. And so his idea was we have to keep people from leaving all their peasant culture and leaving their land and coming to the city, because once they're in the city, life just gets so much worse. So that was our whole, that's what we did the whole 6 years we were in Honduras, and we're going to be talking about that tomorrow. But anyway, so these are the things we encountered, is that we had to basically, we along with the peasants were forced to, you know, to help them farm the land that was not even suitable for farming, like this plot right over here up on the side. You know, the peasants would have this marginal land, and, you know, the flat land would be all sugarcane, cattle, you know, cotton, agro-export crops. Meanwhile, the farmers, they have to farm whatever land is left over. And this used to include the mountainous country where, you know, some of the better land in the high mountains. But now, you know, the coffee is a major export crop. The wealthy people have also bought all the prime mountain country. Okay, so the peasants are the only thing that they have to farm is the marginal land sort of between the high, you know, mountainous, you know, area for coffee and the flat valley land. And it's land that's very steep. You know, there's many places in Guatemala where peasants have to tie themselves in to weed their corn patches. You can see there's a man up here who's hoeing his bean field. Okay, so this is just very, very typical. you know, probably the, by far the majority of Honduran peasants farm land that is not suitable for agriculture. It's steep land like this. Now, the traditional farming practices that have been used all over Latin America and all over Africa for years are, it's called slash and burn farming. And it's a migratory farming approach, practice, and it's very traditional practice. It involves going in with an axe and chopping all the brush, okay, and then basically setting fire to it. And believe me, if you're an organic intensive farmer and you had all these ideals like we did at that time, you know, after working a couple hours under the hot tropical sun, anyone would want a packet of matches and would be tempted to set fire to all this. You know, it's the fast way to do it. And it's a tremendous amount of work, you know, to do anything else. But unfortunately, this approach used to work because farmers would do this and they'd use a plot for 3 or 4 years. You know, when the production started to drop, they would just abandon that plot, you know, let it grow up with weeds and brush again, and they'd move on to a virgin site. And it was, when the populations weren't too dense, you know, that was a possible, it was a workable technique. But with the growth of these, you know, these wealthy landowners and agro-export farmers, you know, on the one hand, and then the population growth on the other, farmers can no longer migrate because there's not enough land for them to migrate to. So what they're doing is they're using the very same slash and burn farming practices year after year on the same land, and the results are just disastrous. You know, land that is where all the organic matter is burned is land that becomes infertile very quickly because there's no organic matter in the soil to hold the moisture and to just increase fertility. And not only that, when it rains, you know, you have no system here to protect the land from the torrential tropical downpours. So what you have is, after a rainstorm, all the creeks and rivers are just, you know, mud. And all the topsoil is just being eroded away. You know, erosion is one of the number one problems that is creating destruction and pushing farmers off the land all over the world. So the results of this are just crops that, you know, that every year look worse and worse and worse. This man, Arturo Donaire, is a friend of mine. I was visiting him in this plot, and he was showing me why he wanted to convert over to the methods that we were promoting. You know, he said, I've been farming this now for 12 years, and it's not worth it. I'm not getting anything, hardly even enough for cows or anything. And when I would ask people why they thought they were poor, you know, why they thought things were going worse and worse and worse for them, most of the people that I talked to would say, you know, it's God's will. We don't know what else would explain it. You know, we've tried everything. The government has sent technicians, and they've tried to help us, you know. Most of these peasants are very uncritical, right? They say, you know, they've come in with these new seed varieties, and they've given us fertilizer, and, you know, nothing has really worked. You know, we can't afford the fertilizer. You know, the seed varieties, you know, most of them weren't very conscious of exactly what was wrong with the seed varieties. You know, hybrid varieties produce a lot, but usually they're much more susceptible to diseases and insects. You know, and if you don't have insecticides and fungicides and all kinds of things, you know, you don't get a yield. You don't get much of a yield. So, you know, the U.S. Has been promoting through USAID for years. They were promoting all these hybrid varieties. You know, and the Honduran Department of Natural Resources, and actually all over Latin America, this was happening. You know, the Green Revolution was being transferred and exported from the U.S. into all of Latin America, and it was just, it wasn't solving, you know, it wasn't appropriate agriculture, it wasn't appropriate technology for these contexts. And so anyway, the people would say, we've tried this, we've tried that, we've tried spacing our rows this way according to this government technician, and, you know, this Peace Corps worker told us about this method, but that didn't work, you know, and, you know, we just figure there's nothing we can do, it's just la voluntad de Dios, you know, the will of God. And that was really our introduction to popular theology, what I call popular theology, or kind of, I call it street theology in this context, but down there, there aren't too many streets. So it's teología popular, you know, which is kind of the base, you know, grassroots, average person's image of God. And what we discovered was really surprising to us in many ways. You know, most people had an image of God as this, it was very, very much a sovereign, you know, very high view of providence. Everything that's happening, everything that happens to you is God's will. You know, if your crops are going bad, it's God's will. And it's God's will because, probably because you're a bad person. You know, God is punishing you. Okay, and if the rich guy down the street, even if he exploits you and you know that, since God is all powerful, you know, the rich guy, God is permitting that rich guy to flourish, and so he must be a good person. Okay, so this was a widespread view that people had, and most people were just completely oppressed by it, but were submitting to it. You know, they were not critical of it at all. They would just say, okay, ¿qué es lo que se puede hacer? You know, what can you do? It's la voluntad de Dios. You know, how can you fight against God? This is our lot. And they would just resign themselves to it. So, but resigning themselves to it meant having to take their kids out of school at a young age. You know, it meant untold suffering. Okay, kids were pulled out of school after the third grade. You know, in our area, I mean, we worked with thousands of people in the course of our 6 years, and by far the majority didn't have anything past a third grade education. If someone had a sixth grade education, they would be considered like the most educated sort of person, like a professional person in the village. Okay, and in many areas where we worked, there'd be maybe one person out of 25 or 30 that could read or write. Okay, and they'd read or write at a very low level. Okay, maybe a third grade level. So that's because families cannot afford to have kids in school. For one thing, they have to pay for uniforms, you know, for pencils and paper and just basic things. And in our area, most of the people wouldn't have any cash on hand. Like, we had a loan program where we loaned people money for picks. We'd buy picks for, you know, for $10 and sell them for $5, so we subsidized it. We would have a lot of people we had a loan program, so we'd give them a pick and they could pay it off as long as, whenever they wanted. And most of them would give us maybe 25 cents, and then the next week they'd pay us another 25 cents, you know. Or a year later they'd come to us and say, oh, finally, you know, I was able to sell my corn, here's the $5. But, I mean, there just wasn't cash in hand for anybody. Okay, so... Anyway, people couldn't afford basic things like uniforms, pencils, paper, let alone, you know, forget about medicine or trips to the capital if you have a major problem, a health problem. So people would have to have their kids, for one thing, they couldn't afford to have their kids in school, but in addition, they needed whatever income that their kids could bring in. They needed their kids to help them. You know, the average family had probably six children, you know, but that's only because maybe three of them had died of dysentery. Okay, and many families that had 9, even 12 kids, and people could not afford to keep their kids in school, so their kids would be out cutting firewood, and as soon as they were able to use a hoe, they'd be out helping their families, you know, hoeing the bean field. Other people, you know, a lot of the men, when they're unable to be productive, there's a tremendous feeling of self-loathing and just a very, very low self-esteem among most of the men. And in addition, just a feeling of hopelessness. And what many people do is, you know, in our area, they would turn to Jugando Naipe, which is like playing Honduran blackjack. I mean, a lot of gambling. Any little coins that people would have or cash, you know, they'd figure, okay, well, you know, I can't, there's no hope farming and there's no hope with God. It's like I might as well just take my chance with luck and, you know, see what I can make. And so they go out to the local corner and they start, you know, a lot of alcoholism as well. You know, people would get into that vice. And so any money that they did have, instead of it going to their kids, would go towards buying alcohol. You know, and alcoholism, almost every man in the countryside throughout Mexico and Central America, at one point or another, goes through, you know, a number of years of serious drinking, you know, which just further grinds everyone down, the whole family into the dust. Others figure, well, you know, the more industrious and sort of adventurous would say, okay, well, the country is just not a place for us. We can't make it. You know, what do? We work for the rich for a dollar a day, or we try to farm our land, and we only have this one plot of land. And the soil's exhausted. We don't know how to improve it. We can't afford fertilizer. Okay, well, let's go to the city. There must be a reason why so many people are going to the city. And that's called the Exodus. You know, in many cultures, that's called the Exodus. I know in Mali, that's the term that is used. You know, all the peasants in Mali, they talk about having to go on the Exodus, going to the big city. And in Honduras, it's many people call it that as well. And this is so anyway. The problem is in the city, what they find is that there they find themselves surrounded by all kinds of people just like themselves. And in Tegucigalpa, you know, unemployment underemployment is about 75%, but unemployment is, I guess, something like 50%. Okay, so once people are in the city, they're even more up a creek. I mean, you know, they have to they have to buy their water, they have to buy, you know, they have to buy their firewood. They can't scavenge anything, you know, and they're completely dependent upon whatever work they can find. And with unemployment so high, many people begin a life of crime. You know, I mean, many, many young people, they join these gangs of kids and they'll go around and rob and steal. And, you know, in the capital cities of Latin America, I mean, the crime has gotten to be so bad. In Honduras, you know, you can't even go out past dark in many parts of the city, you know, because people will kill you for, you know, for $5. I don't know what it's like in Nicaragua right now. You guys have just been there.
It's in kind of collapse.
You know, but there's absolute chaos, you know, and you have all these young people that are coming, you know, that are, I mean, by far the majority of the population in Latin America and the third world countries are made up of teenagers, you know, young people. And these people have no hope for the future. They have no land, they have no hope for jobs, you know, and that's creating just a climate of utter chaos. So instead of having your kids collecting, you know, going out and collecting firewood, many people will have their kids selling trinkets and newspapers and in a much less healthy environment of big Latin American cities. You know, I was recently down in Honduras for 2 weeks. I took a delegation from France down there for this spiritual fraternity that I'm a member of. We took we traveled down together, and we'd had this trip planned before the hurricane, and then you know, then the Hurricane Mitch hit, and so our trip took on a whole new dimension. You know, I was just I'm sure all of you heard about that hurricane. You know, it was pretty much in the press, I guess, all over the United States. And, boy, I was just completely shocked by what I saw when I got to the capital city of Tegucigalpa. You know, the capital was one of the hardest hit areas. And, you know, but of course, Mitch hit Honduras and also Nicaragua. Those are probably the countries that got hit the hardest. And then El Salvador, Guatemala also were hit, but not too much. Much less damage was done. Anyway, the capital, there's a main river that goes right through the center of the city. And this river grew, you know, grew because, you know, of all the rains. I mean, it rained something like, I forget all the statistics, but many, many different, many inches in just a short period of time. And that was after about a month of rain. So all the land was just saturated with water. And then it rained like 5 feet in 5 days, something like that. Okay, so this water just came flooding down the mountains. And, you know, there's a lot of surface area in Honduras because you have all these mountains everywhere. And this water came down into the gullies and just brought all this, you know, rocks and soil, and just this huge flood of water came through this capital and just completely wiped out the, you know, a huge part of the city. And right now I'm sitting on a bridge which is actually, this is a house that we used to have. We had a house for marketing goods. It's right in the market area. And this was a two-story house, a really nice house where that we rented for a number of years. It's just completely wiped out. The whole market area was just covered with water. And this is a bridge going through the middle of a city. The railings were completely wiped out. And, you know, the water went way, way over this bridge, you know, right up to this level. And you can see there's some people there that have handkerchiefs over their mouths, or their hands over their mouths, like this guy. That's because they figured there were as many as a couple thousand people who were still unaccounted for, who were buried in the mud underneath in this pool of water. And it just reeked. I mean, you know, it was a horrendous situation. This was like 3 weeks after the hurricane. So Hurricane Mitch left, you know, hundreds of thousands of people without, you know, I mean, homeless, basically. The little that they've been able to eke, you know, put together was just wiped out. You know, bridges were wiped out all over the country, all over Nicaragua and Honduras. You know, bridges were just completely, you know, these huge floods of water and debris came down, tree trunks and everything, and they would just wipe out all these bridges. And meanwhile, the evangelicals in Honduras used this as a big campaign to say that they would say things like, you know, you think this is bad. This is just nothing. You know, God is just showing just a little tiny sign of what's coming. You know, God is very angry. You know, and God has sent this punishment, but this is just the beginning. This is the birth pangs of what's going to happen. Just wait. You know, turn. You know, repent. If you don't, you're going to experience way worse than Hurricane Mitch. You know, and many people, many sects, like Protestant sects, would, you know, I say like, I don't know, neo-Pentecostal kind of groups, they would say, hey, you know, this is all because the Catholic Church put up this Christ figure, this big statue of Christ over the city, you know, and this is a punishment because of idolatry of the people. Of course, no one would really, and people would point out, well, yeah, you know, God didn't strike the statue and knock it over. In fact, it was a lot of evangelical churches that got wiped out by the hurricane, too. But anyway, this whole perverse theology, the theology of the God who is the angry God, who is the God of providence, who whatever happens is God's will, and only the bad things, of course, and the bad things that happen are punishments. This is just, you know, rampant all over Central America at this moment, in the aftermath of this hurricane. So all these people are technically, according to this theology, being punished by God, you know, and fortunately there's a lot of church people that are coming, you know, that have come in, and you know, the churches have just rallied, or many, many churches have rallied around these people, and lots of aid have come in. So these families, who many of them didn't have any of this stuff, you know, they've got new mattresses and things like that, but there's still a lot of people in these temporary shelters even now. This place was this is about 3 weeks after the hurricane, but in the week, like the first 2 weeks after the hurricane, this place was just jam-packed full of people. I had a friend who lived out in the rural area. We live about 5 hours from the capital out in the country, and he had two of his children studying in a high school in the capital. And he heard on the radio that one of the neighborhoods where his kids were sleeping and were staying, the whole neighborhood had slid in, you know, a big landslide, and all the houses had just been completely buried by a mudslide. And he just, you know, he freaked out and just started walking. And he walked for a day and a half, you know, day and night, and had to wait, you know, for hours and hours and hours in a huge line of other people, like with other people like himself, to go on a canoe across a number of rivers because the bridges were out. And he finally got to the capital, and he said there was just mud, you know, thick everywhere, and just people, and traumatized, you know. And he finally made his way through to the place where his kids were, and found that the whole neighborhood was completely gone. And then heard on the radio that people from that, survivors from that neighborhood were in this center. And he was able to find both of his kids in that center. So this is a man who I've known for the last 18 years. He's a beggar who I've gotten to know personally and seen and supported, you know, whenever I can. And I said, you know, how's it going? You know, what's happened? He goes, oh, you know, I lost my mother, I lost my brothers, I lost everybody in my family. You know, his whole village in Chonoteca, in the south of Honduras, there were whole villages that were completely, completely wiped out. This is an agricultural committee that we worked with. They work with our ministry, which is called Tierra Nueva, New Earth. This agricultural committee is made up of landless farmers, families. And in the mid-80s, they were renting land. And when the U.S. helicopters were flying over, it was amazing. One day I went to plant with them on this land. They had a collective farm that they were planting about 5 acres. And And when I got out in the morning to plant with them, they had they'd written with their picks and shovels, Nueva Vida, New Hope, in just huge letters. And I said, well, you know, why did you write this? He says, because of your compañeros, you know, the helicopter pilots, U.S. Army helicopter pilots. You know, I mean, Honduras was an occupied country during the whole time we were, you know, we were down there. I mean, the U.S. had bases all over the place. They were training the Contras and training the Salvadoran army and training the Honduran army and training their own soldiers. And there were military maneuvers that were just all the time, happening all the time. So these guys, this committee had written this thing, and they said, we just want the army, you know, the people to see that your paisanos, you know, your the soldiers to see that we have hope down here. We're working, we're building an alternative. Anyway, this committee, we ended up eventually finding some money to help them purchase a piece of land. And they had 5 acres. And this land, the river rose, and it completely covered about, I don't know, probably 350 acres of prime farmland that was in the hands of the poor, okay? And also the rich. I mean, there were a number of rich people that owned this. But this particular plot, there 5 feet of pure sand was just covered over their corn, you know, which was just in the ready to harvest almost. And this happened, you know, in many, many places in Honduras. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the barbed wire, the top of the barbed wire fences, okay? Sand everywhere. And the corn, you know, they were like corpses. Mm-hmm. Corn was just riddled, laying all over the place, rotting, you know, completely unusable. So anyway, this is that's sort of to set the context for our discussion of some of the push factors. Why don't we turn on the lights and we can just continue discussing some of these factors. Based on what we've seen right here in these slides, what would you say would be some of the push factors that are pushing, that would push you if you were a peasant in Mexico or Central America, or specifically in Honduras? What are some of the push factors that would be driving, that might be driving people to leave the countryside or even the cities and to, you know, either come from the country to the city or to head north, North America?
Get a job if they're in the city. They're, you know, they can't get a job there, so they, yeah, the way they live. I mean, it would, anything is a push factor, really.
Okay, so lack of jobs, lack of jobs would be a push factor. A pull factor would be to, you know, go to a place where there is a job. And
yeah.
We're going to talk about that more in a couple of days, actually. Just all the, you know, what it is that are, what is pulling people, that's drawing them to leave.
Families to feed, no way to do it.
Families to feed, yeah, hunger.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, for sure, I mean.
I don't think you mentioned it, but there was a pull into armies too, or for sons to go into armies.
Oh yeah, in our area, during the 80s, when we were there, in the early 80s, the U.S. was pressuring the Honduran government to, you know, to like quadruple its army. And they would come into our Honduran army would come into our village, and we lived in this little farmhouse right near the soccer field. And the army would come, and they would surround the whole soccer field, and they would just take all the young people, and they put them in cattle trucks, okay, and they just take them off. And the wealthier families would go, and they, you know, they'd talk to the head guy, head army guy, and they'd pay him some money, you know, and get their kids out, and all the sons of the poor. Of the poorest folks would just be carried off to 3 years in, you know, basic training, or, you know, more than basic training. I mean, 3 years of military service. So definitely, you know.
And a lot of that military service was against their own people, wasn't it?
Well, no, not in Honduras. It was mainly the U.S. was trying to prepare, train the Honduran army so that, see, the U.S. didn't want to use its own troops, and they were doing everything they could to try to promote a war between El Salvador and Honduras. But they wanted to strengthen the Honduran army so the army could do something against the Sandinistas. And they wanted the Honduran army and the Contras to sort of be a force together against the Sandinistas. And then they figured if there was a war, that would give them an excuse to jump in too, right? Yeah, so definitely, I mean, war is a major pushback, and that's why I introduced everything with the Guatemalan example. Because, I mean, you know, all the death squads in Guatemala, you know, I mean, that's a major push factor, is just the terror of not knowing what's going to happen. I mean, we, for many times in Honduras, we work quite closely with the Salvadoran churches. And at times we would leave Honduras to go over, and we would, my wife and I would live with some of the families that were being targeted by the death squads in the churches, you know, and just to be a presence, you know, to be a white Anglo-American presence. Because it was a known fact that was keeping, that was making, I mean, the death squads were way less likely to, you know, to kill someone if American was going to be close by, because that would hurt U.S. aid to the, you know, to the government, right? So using Anglos, you know, white Americans as human shields, you know, was a really effective strategy. And so we would oftentimes go and do that, and we'd stay with families that were targeted, you know, but that never had any kind of support. And I mean, the whole reason that strategy came into being is so many people were killed, you know, and they continued to be killed because there's no way that there was enough, you know, sort of Anglo folks, to Americans, to go around and to provide shields for those people. But, you know, you guys probably heard about Witness for Peace in Nicaragua, and that was a very important movement, you know, putting in church, you know, groups, witness groups into conflictive areas, you know, to be witnesses, and that was effective at making it more difficult for the Contras to do their work. So anyway, war is a push factor, definitely, you know, just the terror, the reign of terror, the death squads, lack of jobs. What else?
Bob, another one, you alluded to this a little bit here, but these countries like Honduras and Nicaragua have huge foreign debts, external debts, and in order to get new loans, they have to shift their economies towards export cropping. So a lot of what used to be self-sufficient agriculture is no longer able to feed the people there. Instead, they're growing bananas, coffee, sugarcane, or winter vegetables. And so people can't even just basically feed themselves anymore.
But how much of that really goes to pay the debt off is what I don't really see many signs that the rich are paying many taxes. It strikes me that most of the folks that I've encountered who were, you know, who were the wealthy landlords, I don't think they were paying.
Yeah.
I mean, it was mainly for their own pockets, you know. Most of them had homes in Miami, and they were, you know, they were sending all their money out of the country. But yeah, I mean, that's...
Yeah, just in terms of the pretext, at least to get the loans, is they've got to cut government spending, so education goes down, healthcare goes down, and they reorient the economy towards export, whether it's free trade zones or agriculture.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're right, very, very little benefits the majority of the people.
Right. Yeah, and there's also the maquilas, you know, the maquiladores in Honduras and all over Central America right now. There's the governments are inviting big multinationals. I mean, they have been for years, inviting them to come in to set up sweatshops, you know, where they can pay workers to, you know, to make clothing, and mainly the garment industry has set up all kinds of sweatshops in Honduras and all through Mexico as well. All over the third world, you know. I mean, just look at the tags in your shirts. You know, most of our shirts are made in those kind of places, our clothing. And the maquilas are, you know, something that's been bigger since NAFTA. But in a way, I mean, that addresses some of the push factors, because those maquilas do provide jobs for people, but the jobs are still inadequate.
Well, they pay so minimally. It's a little like... not a whole lot different for them than working on the coffee plantation as far as having enough money to live on.
Well, they get paid more than what they would make. Oh yeah, they get paid more, but there's a huge dependency that is created on those maquilas. And like in Honduras, the banana company, you know, the banana lands, you know, the Chiquita, and they were just almost completely wiped out by Hurricane Mitch. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard what they've decided to do in the end, but they were saying they weren't going to rebuild. Okay, so here are these, you know, like 10,000 workers or more that have been working and dependent upon, I mean, they've been working for the banana companies for their whole lives, and suddenly they're unemployed. Mm-hmm. And the banana companies, I mean, they did a little bit. They gave them, you know, maybe a month extra pay or something. And they helped out some of the families that were affected, but, you know, but that dependency, you know, now, I mean, what's going to happen to all those workers? So anyway, poverty, lack of, I mean, things like hurricanes, you know, natural disasters are push factors that drive migration. War, lack of education, lack of opportunity for education. In most of these villages, there'd be one teacher, you know, like Holden Village. I mean, it's no different, but of course there'd be 75 kids or something. You know, with maybe one teacher, two teachers in a little schoolhouse, all the grades, right? So lack of education opportunities, lack of doctors. In our area, we lived in an area of about 30,000 people. There was like two doctors, and it was common for them to be gone for a weekend. You know, they'd just close down the medical clinic and they'd be gone. There wouldn't be anyone. You know, we had people that would come to us with serious, you know, like serious, like bleeding to death, just because they knew that we had a suit, we had equipment, you know, for our own selves, right? We weren't medical people, but I've sewed up a number of people, you know, just because there was no one else to do that. So lack of opportunity for health care. I know of cases where women have died because they needed C-sections, and they tried to get on the bus to get to the Capitol, but because they didn't have any money, the bus driver just said, sorry, I can't take you, and they just died on the side of the road. You know, I mean, I know many people that have died in our village who could have easily, you know, been cured if they had the money just to take a bus trip. You know, I mean, you're talking about $25 maybe that they needed, and they didn't have it. And some of those people we've helped out in time, but others, it was just, you know, maybe we'd already left the country or something. So anyway, you have these problems that are growing problems, right? And this is really, I think these are the kind of things, and, you know, unemployment, you know, and then you have a lot of corruption also in the governments, and that there's a climate in Central America and Mexico that is just, you know, it's pretty, pretty bleak, and that's what is driving. These are some of the forces that are really at work pushing people. The other part of it is the theological part. You know, many people see God as aligned with all these forces, you know, since they have this high view of providence. And most peasants, and city people too, for that matter, even people that are active Catholics and active Protestants, they would all have a very similar view of God. Okay, that God is at work in all of these forces. And if you want to get right with God, what you've got to do is just humble yourself and just confess all of your sins, you know, repent, stop drinking, smoking, dancing. And, you know, of course, every denomination, they distinguish themselves by how much rigor there is in their list of things that you have to do to, you know, to kind of please make God like you. And, you know, and the Pentecostals, you know, they're probably the most rigorous. They would say you have to obey the pastor, everything the pastor says. You can't ever set foot into a Catholic church or any other church besides your church, for that matter. And you have to be, you know, you have to be completely. If you have I know a village, in our village, one of the villages where we worked, this guy had been married previously and had five kids, and the marriage hadn't worked out, so he remarried and he had nine kids. And the guy said, well, you have to repent of your adultery and return to your first wife. So the guy left his nine kids and moved in with his wife with five kids, and of course that didn't work.